listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
All right, everybody, this is The Brian Callen Show with my partner in crime, Hunter Mott. And we are waiting for Jonathan Haidt to call in, and if you don't know who he is, and there's no reason you would, he's a very smart guy, and he's got three lectures on TED.com. I always tell people to go to TED.com. It's basically the leaders of thought in everything from technology to art to design to architecture to social engineering, whatever it might be.
And the fact that he has three of them is like unheard of.
Yeah, and each one of them is really illuminating. And I think that we have Jonathan Haidt right now. We're talking about you, Jonathan, singing your praises. How you doing?
Well, yes, I'm so sorry. I forgot that I was supposed to call you guys, but here I am.
No worries, my friend. I have to tell you, I after listening to your lectures on TED, after reading the happiness hypothesis, I called Hunter and I said, I'm so excited. I can't take it. Everything about what you're saying is something that most of us, I think about all the time. So I don't even know where to start, but we'll get into some stuff and we'll get into some, you're essentially a social scientist. Isn't that how you describe yourself?
Well, I call myself a social psychologist.
Okay, a social psychologist. I like it. Where are you calling from? From New York?
Yep, from my office at NYU.
Oh, nice.
At the Stern School of Business, right?
That's right.
That's right. Which in and of itself, the fact that you have a social psychologist who studies religion and, you know, the experience of uplift and transcendence, and that you're at a business school, you know, there's a question that we'll get into later as well,
yeah.
I think.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, your area of focus is morality. I mean, in your book, you basically try to even define, it seems, what love is. What I find very interesting about your work is that, you know, in the way I've been raised, if you read Socrates, if you come from a Catholic or a Judeo-Christian ethic, whatever it might be, you know, you're kind of taught that self-control scripture or just reason or whatever it might be is all you need. And if you don't have self-control, I mean, the Greeks define character as self-control. And we have a society where if you kind of waver from that, you know, you can pay a pretty steep price. But it seems to me that with science and the kind of research that people like you are doing, it seems to me that, you know, and the more we learn about the brain, and you use a lot of examples of this, we are at the mercy of our biology to an extent that we haven't really given credit to over the past, you know, I don't know, 2,000 years or so. Wouldn't you say that's true? I mean, it seems to me that we are biological animals, man, and it's a lot of our behavior is dictated by the way our biology is constructed.
The general view in social psychology is to take the biology for granted that, yep, we sure are animals, and we have a lot in common with other primates, but we have a lot that's new. But so take the biology for granted and then say, boy, does behavior vary across countries and even for the same person from day to day because of the environment. In other words, our biology is so flexible, human behavior is so flexible, that if you just make some little changes to environments, it can make the difference between a person being willing to kill someone or not. I mean, these are the classic Stanley Milgram experiments on whether people are willing to shock somebody to death. Little subtle changes to the instructions or the situation make all the difference in the behavior.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. But what I thought was really interesting about one of your lectures is that you take a look at what I guess a lot of people now agree with, the fact that human beings are born with a blueprint, a first draft in their mind, the notion that people have across cultures essentially reverence for authority, for example, an instinct to care, sort of a nostalgia for sanctity of some kind. You know, the idea that you should, that there's something to worship or revere that we can't explain, that's something that we can't measure. So there are a lot of these things that human beings seem to have an innate composition that they come to the table with right away.
Yes, that's right. So there are a number of things that are incredibly controversial in the social sciences, and innateness is one of them. Anytime you say, well, we just have an innate or a natural, you know, or men naturally want to do this, you're going to get howls of protest from other people who say, oh, but, you know, here's a tribe in New Guinea where they don't do that.
Right.
There's always a tribe in New Guinea.
There's always a tribe in New Guinea.
Sometimes it's the Eskimos as well. But the way to cut through all that nonsense is to say that innate doesn't mean that it's present at birth, mm-hmm. and innate doesn't mean that it's universal. Innate just means structured in advance of experience, but then experience can push things around. So here's one of my favorite examples when I teach about this stuff. 95% of us have brains that are set to be heterosexual. We're attracted to the opposite sex. But in some tribes in New Guinea, actually, there's a book called the Magic of the Flute, something like that. It's by Gilbert Hurt. It's an ethnography of a culture in which all boys, beginning at the age of 7, suck off the older boys, because how do you turn boys into men? Well, they have to get semen, and where can they get semen from? So they develop this practice of all the young boys suck off the older boys, and then at a certain age it reverses, and they donate semen to the younger boys, and then when they reach 17 or 18, they all get married heterosexually.
Unbelievable. I can just see a bunch of pedophiles being like, well, I need, what's yeah, a
where,
way
do,
to,
how, where how is this?
Plane ticket there.
That's the craziest thing.
Okay. So what does that mean? Does that tell us that, oh, heterosexuality is just a social construction? No, what it tells us is that there is an innate predisposition. The boys are disgusted by it at first. They would prefer not to do this, but they get used to it. And then when they're exposed to women, they go for that. So culture can push around behavior. Our biology doesn't dictate our behavior, but it makes certain kinds of behavior easier, more pleasurable, we like it more, and that's what we're finding with politics. That's the coolest finding in the last 20 years about politics, is that people are born with a predisposition to lean left or right. It doesn't mean they're definitely going to be on one side, but, you know, if you have a sibling who just always seemed a little more orderly and neat, well, that sibling is more likely than you to become a Republican.
I found that lecture on TED to be fascinating that you gave. That's right. I mean, it seems to me that there is you're sort of, my sister's always been just more conservative than I have about just her everyday life. I was always open to new experiences. I'm a foodie. I love, you know, different experience. Maybe because I grew up overseas my whole life. I don't know what it is, but she
so
did.
Your sister.
Well, so
yeah.
did she. And she, exactly. I left home at 13 to go. I wanted to go to school, away to school. I wanted to experience different things. And she was a homebody. And obviously that had to have been at least partially biological.
That's
you know?
Correct. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, identical twins who share 100% of their genes are very similar in all these things, whereas fraternal twins who only share 50%, they're not 50% similar, they're as different as next-door neighbors. They're as different as people who don't share any genes at all.
Well, that was fascinating to me when you described, you know, and I've read these before, the sort of you have identical twins separated at birth. When they meet, sometimes they're wearing almost the same thing.
That's right. All that weird stuff about, you know, oh, well, they both had three dogs and named them all Fido, and they both push up their, you know, they both push up their reading glasses with their pinky. All those weird similarities, they happen with identical twins separated at birth. They never happen with fraternal twins separated at birth.
You have the book is controversial because, you know, you draw these you know, conclude you point to the fact that we have a biology, but then it can be, you know, it can be influenced by environment. And then you talk about how one can change, which is always a very difficult thing to do, but how one can change their essential personality, if you will, or whatever. And that is through three things, which I found really amazing. Meditation.
Medication.
Meditation.
Yeah,
cognitive
medication. That's right. Both of them.
Cognitive therapy, I think, and then finally Prozac, which was amazing. And you're a fan. I mean, you know, the way you describe Prozac, I've never taken an antidepressant, but boy, I guess the evidence suggests that when taken responsibly, it can have a profound and positive effect on people who have even personality disorders like being, I don't know, overly irritable or selfish or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah, that's right. So this is from the happiness hypothesis. when I did research on how do you change your basic level of happiness or anxiety and all those sorts of things, mm-hmm. and I found three, and that you mentioned the three that I think are really the best validated. And of the three, what I found is that meditation is the one that you can recommend most wholeheartedly. It's mm-hmm. been done for thousands of years. There's not a single negative side effect. It has all these really good things about it. But what I found, when I've assigned it to my students in large lecture classes, I used to do a self-improvement project in my Psych 101 class, what I found is that the great majority of students will ditch it within a couple of days. It's hard.
Yes.
And so if you assign 100 people to it, very few will really
stick
with it.
Well, first of all, define what meditation is. What do you tell them to do? There's all different kinds of meditation.
Yeah, I would give them sound files from Jon Kabat-Zinn, a sort of a guided meditation, guides them in how to sit still with your back straight upright in a comfortable position. It's really just a way of focusing attention on your breathing, for example, which is a way of, here's one of my favorite psychological statements in of all time. It's from Homer Simpson, who says, he says, "Shut up, brain, or I'll stab you with a Q-tip." And so meditation is a much less violent way of getting your brain to shut up. And if you can do that for just 10 minutes a day over the course of even just a few weeks, you begin to just find that you don't have as much garbage going through your head. Meditation is great, but it's really hard.
I tell a lot of young people that, you know, just as a stand-up comic, as you develop a following, if you come back to the same city, you got to have new jokes, man. You can't just show up with the same stuff. So you're always in the process of writing. And one of the things that I wish somebody had told me a long time ago when I was younger is that thinking, being creative, learning how to allocate your mental space in a productive manner really is a question of almost deletion or not indulging in things. It's almost like a passive process. For me, you know, my cognitive therapy or my meditation is learning what not to think about, learning how to keep negative thoughts out of my head. And I found, I'd read Malcolm Gladwell, but you also cited in your book, where if you talk about old people, people will leave a room slower. Words have a powerful effect on our physiology and our biology.
Well, that's right, because our minds are neural networks. We're not rational computers that process information. We're neural networks where if you're exposed to a little something over here, it triggers a neuron over there, and before you know it, you're thinking about that thing you did that you wanted to forget about.
And I think that's one of the really interesting things. You have a paper called The Emotional Dog and Its Rational Tail.
Another
great
paper.
Which was awesome.
Yeah, let me just stop for a second.
Yeah.
You guys read all my work? What do you
do all day? Dude, listen. When Hunter Motz...
Are you stalking me?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Well, no, this is what happened, John. Hunter Motz, who's my partner in crime here, who went to Harvard and speaks six languages, and he's one of the smartest guys I know, and he's read everything. And he said, The Happiness Hypothesis is one of my favorite books I've ever read. Oh, and by the way, this guy, Jonathan Haidt, is a rock star. Watch him on TED. And when he gives a glowing recommendation like that, I jumped in and my mind was just as blown. I called him yesterday. I go, I can't wait to talk to this dude because this is, you know, everything about what you kind of talk about and the research you do is, I think, has relevance to all of us. It's just something we think about, we talk about, not as eloquently or as detailed as you do, but it has relevance to all our lives. So
that's why I went into study psychology. What could be more interesting than studying people and how they work and how to run your brain better and how to run other people's brains better?
Yeah,
right.
Well, you're good at it. You know, somehow you make it very relevant. But go ahead, ask the question.
Yeah, but what you're describing in terms of, you know, us being primed by these words like old people or whatever it is that very much, you know, thinking is much more of a bottom-up process than a top-down process, you know. You give the analogy of the rider and the elephant in both The Happiness Hypothesis and The Righteous Mind. And the idea is that there's this large, unwieldy elephant that is, you know, our subconscious brain and that drives most of our actions. And then, you know, us, the thinking part of our brain, is this tiny little rider on top. And, you know, all we can do is sort of nudge the elephant one way or the other. But the thing I was going to say is, you know, what I think is so fascinating and really underpins your second book is that degree to which, you know, we feel first and then we come up with a reason to justify our feeling. So we feel
that's the fundamental rule of moral thinking, moral judgment, and political arguments. They're not based on reasoning. They're based on intuition. And then we all use our reasoning to hurl arguments at the other side.
Well, and you use these really difficult examples. A brother and sister decide to have sex. They're in the woods. One is on the pill. The other one uses a condom. And all of us go, I read that and I went, all right, hold on. I don't know why that's wrong. It just is.
Yeah, it just is.
Yeah, and explain how we're supposed to reconcile those kinds of things. What is that inherent sort of revulsion for masturbating with a chicken and then eating it? you know what I mean? We kill the chicken, we pluck it, we eat it, but masturbating with it, I got to draw the line, brother.
That's right. Yeah, so I got my start. I got interested in morality when I was in graduate school at the University of Pennsylvania. And in 1987, when I joined psychology, everybody was talking about issues of rights and fairness and compassion. So those were really the two areas, sort of rights, or I should say fairness and compassion. That was all what morality was. But I took a course from an anthropologist named Alan Fiske, and I read about a lot of other cultures. And, you know, you've traveled widely, Brian. You've lived in other places. In much of the world, it's not all about fairness and compassion. I mean, there's,
no.
You know, if you look at the Old Testament or if you read the Quran, boy, does God seem to care about food and sex and how you handle your body and
That's
menstruation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And why is that? Why do so many cultures care about this stuff? So I began studying that, and I began realizing that disgust is a really important moral emotion in most of the world and for most of human history. And what happened in the 20th century in the West is that disgust began to fade out. So I used to collect sex manuals, these like books that were written for young people 100 years ago. Mm. And if you just – you turn to the masturbation chapter, and you can tell if it was written before or after 1920. Because before 1920, it's all about how – oh, and you know, if you abuse yourself and drain your seed, you know, you will pollute this. It's just, you know, horrible, horrible stuff. And after 1920, you get a bit more of a scientific, hygienic idea. All that purity stuff begins to fade out from our public discourse, but it's still there in our minds.
Mm.
And you get this idea that the body is a temple. And you see it a lot. So, you know, on the right, the political right, they seem much more concerned about sex as a way of desecrating the temple and gay sex and all that stuff. But on the left, you actually see a lot of this thinking about food.
That's right.
And the left is often in a panic about genetically modified organisms, because the left is often suspicious of corporations and capitalism. So, you know, things made by big food. I mean, now, of course, the big food industry really is corrupt. I'm not defending them.
No, but I understand. Saying,
yeah.
So the left is kind of in a panic about food and the way that food can desecrate the body.
Well, food is almost a religion for the left. It really is almost a religion. Look at vegans and things. I talk about this all the time. Stand-up. I mean, it's amazing how that's exactly right. And that points to what you say initially. We have this nostalgia for purity, for sanctity. You know, that seems to be a very real human impulse.
Right. But it varies certainly across cultures. I did some work in India, which is probably the world's most articulate culture about sanctity and purity and pollution and all these rites you do to purify. I sometimes talk about what I call the Dawkins-Cass dimension. Richard Dawkins is about as low as can be on this dimension. It's just very, you know, a secular worldview with all the
radical atheist. Yeah.
And Leon Cass, a very interesting philosopher, is at the other end. He has a phrase from an article called The Wisdom of Repugnance. He says, "Shallow are the souls that have forgotten how to shudder." So this is a debate we have. It's between left and right now, as to whether things are wrong only if they hurt people, or whether there's some things we simply shouldn't do because they're not in our nature, they're incompatible. It's difficult to discuss this stuff, but that's what's behind a lot of our arguments over abortion, gay marriage, gay sex. A lot of stuff that has to do with the body is really purity stuff.
So are we becoming more relativist or more absolute as we?
No, we're becoming more relativist because what happened? The normal human condition, if you don't have a lot of diversity and mobility, is that morality thickens up. So morality. So you know, a metaphor I use in the book is that morality is the matrix, like the movie The Matrix.
Sure.
The matrix is a consensual hallucination, and so this is our great trick as a species: is we're able to create these consensual hallucinations. Nations, these moral orders, and then we can live together, trust each other, punish each other. You know, we have a culture.
Mm.
And if you're on a little island or you're isolated, well, you come to think that your matrix is absolutely real and correct and there's no other alternative. And what happens when you start having immigrants and mobility and diversity is you start having to say, well, they believe something different from us. Should I make room for it? Maybe mine isn't right. So what happens is as mobility and diversity increase, people do tend to get more relativist. They don't have a shared moral order. And this is a threat that conservatives are very, very concerned about. They really want social cohesion. I think they're not wrong to want it. Liberals tend to embrace the change. They embrace relativism much more easily.
Well, but there's another side to that, and that is as we learn more about our biology, for example, serial killers have different brains, they
yes.
find, than normal people. Their amygdala or whatever is not as developed or whatever. So as we are able to sort of, measure immorality as it's expressed biologically with finer and finer instruments, what does it say about morality? What does it say about punitive action for crime? Well, we're really in new yeah. territory here, aren't we?
Yes, we are. But I think it's not quite as difficult yet as you're suggesting. Mm. So there are psychopaths. 1% of men are psychopaths. Now, this appears...
Women might argue the percentage is slightly higher.
You know why they argue that? Because this 1%, these guys... They pick up women, they abuse them, they leave them. So every woman has been, certainly every attractive woman who's been out in public has been hit on by a psychopath. Mm. And so, it gives the rest of us a bad name.
That's right.
So this 1%, they account for half of all the cops that get murdered. They account for half of all the serial rapists. So this 1% really is bad news. It's a genetic strategy, actually. It makes sense in men. It makes no sense genetically to have a female psychopath because, women don't gain anything by just having random sex and then abandoning the partner. So psychopaths, that's totally separate. We need to understand them. And, of course, we can't lock them up based on a genetic test. But once they do commit a crime, it's very important that we keep them in jail because
right.
if you let them out, they just go right back to committing crime.
Yeah, they have no compassion.
That's right. They have no conscience.
Yeah.
But that's just 1%. Leave that aside, and what you get is the rest of us, sure, our brains make us do things. It's not as though I did this bad thing, but my brain had nothing to do with it. But the more we learn about the brain, that doesn't really absolve us of responsibility. It does help us understand why people vary. But we will never be in a society in which we say, oh, we can't punish him because, his personality predisposed him to that.
Sure.
So I'm not too worried that neuroscience is going to really undermine
moral responsibility. No, I'm not either. I mean, there was a book a long time ago I read called The Moral Sense, and I don't know if you ever heard of it, but one of the things he makes an argument for is that human beings have an inherent morality, a sense of morality, in that even the Nazis, you take extreme examples, yeah. believed that, the higher echelons believed in their own sick, twisted mind that they were solving a problem. Get rid of these Jews and these gays and these other people in society will be purified. I mean, the 20th century is full of one of the most destructive ideas, in fact, for according to some philosophers of the 20th century, was the idea that human beings could be perfected, that that you could
That's
create
right.
a utopia, and all you had to do is get rid of these people over here, the way people like Mao and Stalin and Hitler did. That's a very, very dangerous idea, of course, as we now
absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's right. So you're referring to one of the great books in moral psychology by James Q. Wilson called The Moral Sense. But it's instructive to think about the Nazis because on the one hand, what they achieved in terms of taking on the world and being relatively successful in prosecuting these atrocities, what they achieved was to a large extent motivated by moral concerns, as you say. You'd never find a genocide committed for money. People don't commit genocide for money. Hmm. They commit genocide because they hate the other side. They always think they're a contaminant. You find the same logic and rhetoric in the Rwanda massacre
right.
as you do in the Holocaust about how they're cockroaches, they're vermin. So morality plays a role. But at the same time, when you read about what the men in the Third Reich had to do, a lot of the SS, they had to drink heavily. They were horrified. They would just shoot Jews in the back of the head all day long, but they hated it.
Mm-hmm.
They were horrified by it.
Mm-hmm.
So even then, it's not as though they completely lost all human sense. The environment and the culture was so powerful and so perverted that it was able to change their behavior. And some of them embraced it, but most of them still had some human feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a famous story. I think it was Himmler or someone when his troops were shaking, these young boys were going through the Russian countryside and just killing, you know, anybody who was in mass graves and just shooting these people. And these young boys were shaking. They couldn't put this into context that you shoot a woman holding her child into a mass grave.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was very important was to figure out, that's where propaganda and symbolism and those kinds of things and creating cohesion within the tribe around slogans and around a philosophy that young people could actually sink their teeth into. That became very important for the Third Reich.
Yep, that's right. Hitler and his henchmen were masters of moral psychology, rhetoric, use of emotions, awe, inspiration. So, you know, I study all these moral emotions, but when I call them moral emotions, that doesn't mean that they are good. That means they are part of our moral nature. And our moral nature is the crown jewel of human nature. It allows us to have civilization, but it also allows us to have genocide, war, racism, and everything else.
Well, so Jonathan, what do we do? Give me a practical, utilitarian way of living my life then now. I mean, the more we learn, we still have an inherent sense of what's right and wrong. I really think we know the difference.
Yep.
I mean, I certainly do.
Okay. You want some advice from moral psychology? Here you go.
Yes.
A lot of our public thinking over the last 50 years has been influenced by economists and others who tell us that people are basically selfish. We want money, we want prestige, and that's about it. Ditch all that. That is okay maybe for strangers interacting in a marketplace. But in our real lives, what we crave even more is to be part of something larger than ourselves, to do something in the company of people that we respect, to be part of a team. I work on a college campus. I've been on college campuses my whole adult life. And, you know, the students are competitive. They want to get good grades and good jobs. But, man, they spend so much of their time joining groups, working for this cause. You know, I noticed even on your webpage, you know, you've got appeals for charity. We actually do care about a lot other than just wealth. So if you want to know how to live your life, here's the dictum. Happiness comes from between. It doesn't come from getting what you want. It comes from getting the right relationship between yourself and others, yourself and your work, and yourself and something larger than yourself.
Well, that goes to reciprocity, doesn't it? I mean,
That's right. Reciprocity is a big part of how to get along with people. If we don't just want to take everything we can. We want to have good relationships with people, and we are generally primed to pay back both favors and insults.
I love that whole paragraph that you just hit us with. That really does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I speak in paragraphs.
Yeah, I love it. I that was actually a very clear way of going
articulate,
about it.
Yeah.
You know. You read Socrates, and they were always concerned with these questions in the dialogues, Plato's dialogues, which I always recommend to younger people. I say, just start with the Greeks, and then you can go from there. And you know, they were always concerned with this question: can virtue be taught? For example, mm-hmm. How do you define love? In fact, the Socrates said love has to be defined as love of, and man loves immortality. He wants to leave an imprint of himself, whether it's through his children or through his work. Right? I mean, would you agree with the, where do you diverge from the Greek notion of virtue? Can virtue be taught or does it have to be remembered? Where is your stand on that?
First, let's distinguish between Plato and Aristotle. So Plato was the ultimate rationalist. Plato and through Socrates, his mouthpiece or spokesman. Socrates was reported to have said the unexamined life is not worth living.
Right.
Well, you know, that's great if you're a philosopher and you're going to say everybody should live like we philosophers. And if you don't live like a philosopher, you might as well kill yourself because what good are you?
That's right.
You know, but the man of action would say, well, the unlived life isn't worth examining. And you eggheads up on the Acropolis, why don't you go do something?
That's right. We're physical beings too.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, So I'm a little bit down on Plato. Obviously, he was this extraordinary mind who gave us modern philosophy. But for my taste and from my view as a social psychologist, it's way too rationalistic. He places way too much faith in the rider, mm-hmm. if you know the rider and elephant metaphor that Hunter introduced before. So in fact, look, the clearest case of it is this: Plato's model for human nature is this. We are like a charioteer in which the charioteer is reason. And reason can control the unruly passions. The passions are the horses.
Yeah, he never met me. He never met me.
Okay.
He never met an actor on a TV show when he's a young guy in L.A.
That's true, especially about comedians. You guys, yeah. I don't know what you guys are on, but you
we're degenerates. We're degenerates.
They're the 1%, yeah. And we don't mean the 1% with all the financial wealth.
I'm an appalling human being. Anyway, keep going.
So Plato urges us all to be philosophers who cultivate our self-control and then reduce our emotions. And he told us that if a man succeeds in doing this, then he will be reborn into the next life, not on this earth, but back up in heaven. And if he fails to develop self-control, then he'll be reborn as a woman. That's what the Greeks thought about reason and emotion.
Right.
But I think David Hume got it much more correct. Mm. David Hume, the 18th century Scottish philosopher,
yep.
He said reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them.
Mm.
And I got to say, you know, as a psychologist, there are exceptions to that. Of course, we can think rationally about some things, but things that engage our emotions, politics, morality, all these sorts of things, the feelings come first, and then we don't set our reasoning doesn't go out and say, well, what's true? Our reasoning is given instructions. Those instructions are, find evidence for what we want to believe. And you go out, you look for evidence, you almost always find it. Sometimes you don't. You say, boss, I couldn't find anything. We got to change our mind on this. But usually you find something.
Right.
And this is why, you know, Americans can argue. There's recent findings about, the NSA, all the spying going
sure.
on. Well, Democrats actually support it, the majority.
Mm.
Whereas when the Bush administration was doing it, and that was a more severe program and it was less legally justified, but you had a massive flip because both sides are saying, you know, if you like Obama, you'll say, well, is this okay? Is this justifiable? And you can find justifications that you say, okay, I got it. It's justified. But when it's the other guy doing it, you say, must I believe it's justified? And you no, I don't have to believe it. You find some other argument. So our reasoning is really more like a servant than it is like Plato's charioteer.
Well, isn't the key then realizing that that's true about you, right? And approaching your own reasoning and all that sort of stuff with a certain skepticism and checking in with what's your emotional state.
Got it.
And
exactly.
Yeah.
And that's right. That gives you a lot more humility, what you might call epistemic humility, that is about knowledge. You don't know everything, and you're overconfident in what you think you know. But even more important than understanding yourself, I think it really helps you understand others. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
people will say things. I mean, this is so important in marriage. You know, your spouse will say something, and if you take it literally and seriously, you'd say, oh, my God, I can't believe you said that, and this is grounds for divorce. But if you understand where people are coming from and that they're saying things based on what they're feeling at the moment, and if you try to empathize, you can understand those feelings, you can become a lot more forgiving.
Well, you're very ambitious in that. Your goal in some ways, certainly your lectures are that, listen, we have a real polarization in our political life in this country.
Yeah.
You know, blue versus red, and the reds are dummies and the blues are smart. And there are these very strong prejudices and in a lot of ways, you talk about how congressmen today and senators say they've never seen this kind of polarization.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. So, yeah, that is my fondest hope for the book, is that everyone in America and everyone in Congress will read my book and then suddenly say, ah, I understand the other side. I don't agree with it, but I don't think that they're stupid and evil. That's what happened to me. I was a Democrat, a liberal Democrat my whole life, and I actually set out to do this research on political psychology. I set out in 2004 to do it to help the Democrats, because after both Gore and Kerry – They just made such stupid moral appeals. They just didn't understand American morality. Mm. And here I was studying conservatives and people in traditional societies, and I felt I can help the Democrats do better.
Wow.
So I started really studying, immersing myself. I had TiVo, and I would start TiVoing Fox News shows, and I would watch Glenn Beck and all those guys. And at first I really hated them, but actually after a while I realized, you know, they're not at all crazy, and I never looked at the news of the day that way. Actually, he's got a point there.
Right.
And it's if you're not even exposed to the arguments, then you end up just having your little cohesive moral world shared with the people who think like you.
Which is a very dangerous thing, right? That's how tribes, that can be the glue for a tribe that then says we hate this other side because they basically are the enemy. Yeah.
That's right, and that's where we are. So that's the, you know, there are three principles of moral psychology in the book. We've covered one of them, which is intuition comes first, strategic reasoning second. The second principle is there's more to morality than harm and fairness, and we talked about that already. And then the third principle is morality binds and blinds. And that's where we are as a nation. We've got these two teams. Our political system is a duopoly. There's only two parties, unfortunately. There can't be a third, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And what everybody's focused on isn't what's good for the nation. It's how can we beat the other side? How can we humiliate them? You know, good policy ideas. Obama has embraced a number of policy ideas that came from Republican think tanks. But the mere fact that Obama proposes them means the Republicans are now going to oppose them.
Well, I mean, even the health care bill is very similar to what the Heritage Foundation put out,
exactly,
from what I understand.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. It's
Heritage, that's right. Heritage came up with the ideas for how to still have a market-based insurance system.
Mm-hmm.
Romney embraced it, developed it. It works pretty well in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Obama thought he would be conciliatory, meet him halfway, didn't go for single payer. But it's gang warfare in Washington,
yeah.
And the Republicans were going to be damned if they let Obama have a success. And how can you run a country this way?
It's impossible. Maybe it's good that the federal government is paralyzed and they can let us all just live our lives. I mean, I find myself to be more of a libertarian in a lot of ways. I just believe in maximum personal liberty and just let people.
You know,
make
this
their
is. So look, Brian, I got to ask. I did a comedy show here in interview with the guys here at the Comedy Cellar in New York.
Oh, cool.
I've always found that creative types, you know, as you were saying before, creative types are almost always on the left. But it turns out comedians tend not to be liberal. Some of them are conservative, but most of them are libertarian. Is that true? Do you
well,
think comedians are?
I think that what happens is comedians live in a real marketplace, Jonathan. Like, if I don't make people laugh, if I don't get people in the seats, man, if I don't figure out a way to get people to come to my show, if I don't figure out a way to make them laugh, then I lose. There's no second place. There's nothing I can do. And it's also a place where my job is to surprise and shock you. That's what you laugh at.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't be politically correct. I've got to just deal with the truth as I see it. When I write my material, I'm not thinking about being funny. I'm actually just thinking about what's really going on with me. What's the truth of who I am? It's why, you know, I always say my friends know exactly who I am, man. They know my thorns and everything else. Nothing. Like the other day, yesterday, I was with Ronda Rousey, who's a fighter, UFC champion, and my buddy Brendan Schaub is another fighter. And I was so excited to be there with Ronda Rousey, and I started telling a story about a fight I got into. And in the middle of the story, my wife looked at me and she went, "You didn't." She was with me. And she goes, "You didn't say that. You didn't say you wanted to fight the guy." And I said, "Yes, I did." And she goes, "No, you didn't. You said you wanted to go make up with him." And I said, "Well, that you ruined my story. I've been telling the story that way. And apparently I must have thought it, but I was lying and exaggerating about that story. And by the way, I want to keep it that way. I don't even know if I'm going to change it in the future." Part of being a comic is being very honest with yourself and being publicly honest in that sense. And I think somehow that lends itself. Whenever I see a company getting bailed out, whenever I see anything being socially engineered,
mm-hmm.
I think what happens to me is I say, well, I don't live in that world. That would never work for me. I wouldn't be allowed to do that. Why are these banks getting bailed out by the federal government? Because they made mistakes. Nobody cares about my mistakes. You either laugh at me or you don't. You either come to my show or you don't. And if I don't make money, that's the way it is.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
That's very interesting because there are certain experiences that pull people to the left or to the right.
Mm.
So foreign travel tends to pull people to the left, but starting a small business or becoming a parent tends to pull people a bit more to the right.
Right.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that comedians are more like, you know, compared to other artists, Yeah. Comedians are more like small businessmen, which pretty quickly stamps out the sort of the, you know, the left-leaning compassion for everybody. Oh, don't let anybody suffer. Don't punish anybody.
Very much so. Is, you know, and remember, yeah. we're also alone. I spend, when I'm on the road, I'm alone all day in a hotel room trying to come up with jokes and writing stuff. Then I'm on stage alone. It's a very solitary process. So we also spend a lot of time as individuals on the outside looking in. And I think some of that lends itself to the idea of I don't want anybody getting in my way. Let me express myself as I see fit. It's not going to be. It may not be to your liking, but it'll be interesting, and you'll be watching me. So maybe some of that is there as well. So I think that's why a lot of it's funny because comics I talk to think that they're left wingers, and then I start asking them questions, and you find very quickly that they're actually libertarians.
That's right. I think part of it is also a lot of you guys are curmudgeons. I mean, you just kind of not warm and fuzzy. And what I found out about libertarians, I've done a lot of research on left, right, and libertarian. My research team at yourmorals.org, we have this the best data in the world on libertarians. What we find is that they are the smartest people out there. They're the most rational. They're lower on emotionality, and they're more loners.
Yeah.
So I guess that profile, that maybe that would draw libertarian leaning folks more into comedy, make them very effective there.
Yeah, I don't know. I think about my own children. How do I raise my own children? I'm not religious. I don't come from an organized sort of religion. I have trouble even teaching my children that. So what I find myself saying is I got to figure out where my children, what their propensity is, what their primal urges are. Where should they place their energy? I think my son loves to drum, and my daughter loves to ride horses and sing. Whatever that is, my job is really to kind of nudge them in the direction that they want to be anyway. And my philosophy is that if you really throw yourself into something you love and try to be the best at it, it almost takes care of itself. You don't have time to get drunk and smoke weed all day and do blow and all those things. You just don't if you're passionate about – it's like getting in shape. I always say if you can feel the difference of what it's like to eat well and work out, how you – human beings are always sort of running away from pain and toward pleasure. Mm-hmm. That's how I think that's kind of how I try to simplify – my philosophy and because like you say in the book, there's a lot of information out there, man. Mm-hmm. It's hard to kind of put everything into context, especially as a young person.
And there's a lot of information that at a first glance makes a lot of sense until you then think about the other consequences. I think your perspective on Buddhism, for example, is fascinating. Because, one of the things you say is that, Buddhism is about not feeling attachment towards things. And that absolutely does solve the problem of if you're not attached to things, you're not going to be disappointed and all that sort of stuff. But of course, when you look more closely, so much of what makes life best is our attachments.
Absolutely. I love that about what you said. Yeah. I love that you said that. That's right. I forgot about that.
But I think, if you think about, if you put the story of the Buddha in a modern Western context, right? Here's a rich kid. He's never experienced adversity. He experiences adversity. He doesn't like it very much. And so he stops caring and stops doing anything. Right?
Then he tries to change the world, kind of like Jonathan Haidt.
When
I was in college in my 20s, I was so drawn to Buddhism, and I really thought that it was the wisest philosophy out there. And while I still actually do think that, but I think that approaching life as a Buddhist makes a lot more sense for an older person, and that for a young person to strive for non-attachment I think is stunting and warping, especially in the modern West, where the world really is pretty safe and
fun.
And fun. That's right. Yeah. That's right. And who is it? Was it Saint Augustine? God give me self control, but just not yet.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Or I love H.L. Mencken's description of a Puritan. He says, I think Puritans are essentially the haunted feeling that someone somewhere is having fun.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I think that there are certain things that are appropriate when you're much older, and it is. Ugly to see a person in their 60s or 70s who has no equanimity, who's still so concerned about how he or she is perceived. But by the same token, to meet a 20-year-old who isn't striving, who doesn't glory when he or she has a success, or doesn't have her heart broken when she's dumped, I think it is good to be attached to the world intensely. to strive and fail. We learn from failure. We learn from the pain of failure. It helps us grow.
Absolutely, man. I think that's even important to expose your children to. My wife gets mad at me because sometimes I'll throw a tantrum in front of the 2-year-old and the 5-year-old. But I'm just being honest with my feelings, and I find that it's way healthier. I always have humor to it anyway. And they're gonna see what the real world's like anyway. I'm not freaking out and being abusive, but you know, we try to build these cages around things. And the truth, like you used this example of Ed, what the hell is his name? Ed Schacht or whatever that guy's name. The truth finds its way in one way or another. You can pretend for just so long, and it'll manifest itself. And a lot of times, it'll manifest itself, in my opinion, physically. Even if I'm lying in my life, my back starts to hurt. I'm telling you, my lower back starts to hurt. It actually manifests itself in this sort of physical thing, you know.
Some sort of weird reverse Pinocchio, I suppose.
This is true.
Here's something that I also really find fascinating, because, you know, this book was your book, The Happiness Hypothesis, was really transformative for me. Because, you know, I was raised, I mean, you know, I very much grew up as a scientist, you know, and really valuing reason and valuing rationality. And through the course of that book, I realized that the impulse towards religion, that is something that we all have. We all have that desire for transcendence, that desire for awe, and that we can try and deny that, but it is there. And I think the interesting thing is that if you look at the new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins, right, who really believe that they are purely rational individuals, you know, a lot of their personal cosmology, it bears a lot of similarity to religion in the sense that there's a disgust for the opposition, right? Yep. There's an awe and reverence for science. And even, as you were talking about the Nazis and all that sort of stuff, a lot of these secular organizations are actually just religions without a clear God.
Exactly. That's something we see. I did an analysis of the New Atheists' books. I took electronic files of their books, and I fed them into a linguistic analysis program, which counts up different kinds of words. And it has a category for words about certainty. You know, if you say certainly, definitely, there is no doubt, things like that. Well, this is not a scientific way of talking.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what I found is that Sam Harris scored the highest.
Wow.
On those words.
Wow.
Followed by Glenn Beck, Ann Coulter, all those right wing talks. They were lower than Sam Harris and mixed up with Richard Dawkins.
Amazing.
So Dawkins and Harris are right up there. And Dennett too. Dennett is not as angry as the others, but Dennett also uses these certainty words.
Well, these are orthodox fundamentalist terms, right? I mean, they're fundamentalists. Yep. Yeah.
That's right. There's a lack of open mindedness. There's a commitment to a truth. So one thing I say in the book is follow the sacredness. And around it, you'll find a ring of motivated ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
So if you treat science as sacred, or the truth as sacred, then you're going to start thinking in all sorts of weird and incorrect ways. I'm a scientist. I think the truth is extremely important. I think science is great, but I don't treat it as sacred. Science often has flaws. There are things we can fix. So I think the new atheists, they rally around a vision of science as the savior and religion as the devil, and then they have all that religious psychology activated.
And especially because the whole basis of science, the reason why it's such a powerful way of understanding the world, is because it's founded in doubt. It's not founded in faith.
Yes, but I would put it a little bit differently. It's an institution in which anything you say will be challenged by others. So
mm-hmm.
It's not that any of us scientists are so good at doubting. We may not be better. We're not necessarily smarter.
Right.
It's that we are locked into an institution where whatever we say is going to be challenged by others. That's why it works. And that's actually one of my concerns about my field, about social psychology right now, is that because there are no longer any conservatives in the field, there are some biases here and there where people will say something which sounds like liberal common sense. It may not be right, but there's nobody out there to challenge it. So we
mm-hmm.
have some systematic breakdowns in the challenging process.
And that's, I mean, one of the things we talk about a lot on this show is checks and balances, which is, of course, the structure of our government, and again and again. And there's a great quote that you have from The Righteous Mind, which, if you don't mind, I'd like to read on the air. When I was a teenager, I wished for world peace, but now I yearn for a world in which competing ideologies are kept in balance. Systems of accountability keep us all from getting away with too much, and fewer people believe that righteous ends justify violent means. Not a very romantic wish, but one that we might actually achieve.
Hmm. That's pretty cool. Wish I'd written that. You're smart, Richard. Stop being so smart. I literally, as I'm listening and talking, I'm kind of daydreaming. I'm going, I wish I'd written that shit.
but that's what I'm saying. There's basically what you said earlier, Brian, about utopians. You know, when I was a kid, I grew up in the 70s, and I wanted, you know, world peace and an end to world poverty and all these things. And, you know, you realize as you get older, it's a miracle that we have civilization at all. Mm-hmm. I'll take it, and then let's just try to make it a little better if we can. And that's, you know, that's basically what that quote was about.
So one other question that I have for you, because, you know, everybody's aware that the sort of the danger, the problem of religion is, or even politics, is that it makes us irrational. Right.
Yeah.
And it gives us that sense of certainty that our way is it's our way or the highway. Only our view is correct. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing is that you see a lot of people now, you know, the sort of atheism and all that sort of stuff. We've sort of been burned by the religious wars of the past. And we're saying, you know, we want to no longer have that religious or that transcendent experience or anything like that. But the thing that it always makes me think of is romantic love. Because you have the same problem with romantic love. It makes you irrational. It makes you crazy. It makes you do things that are not sane. But you're not really going to find too many people in the modern world who are saying, oh, we should avoid experiencing romantic love. So why do you think that we need transcendence in our lives? Do you think we need to find ways to find it? And then just bear in mind that we might be crazy?
That's a very interesting juxtaposition. I guess the way I'd think about it is that there are a variety of commitment devices. That is, if you start from the economist's assumption that we're all selfish, greedy bastards who do things to the extent that they bring us reward, and then you say, well, what are the cases where we don't do that? What are the cases where we commit to another person, where we actually will do things that might be bad for us, but we want to help the other person? Mm. So love is such a commitment device, and society is certainly better off when people have a lot of love, when people mm-hmm. are committed to their spouse and their children. Boy, are we better off. So I don't think love has a very bad track record as a commitment device. You falling madly in love with your wife doesn't detract from my world. It actually makes it more stable and means that I don't have to support your kids because you're more likely to support them.
Love is also complicated in that, you know, some philosophers will say we actually go to war over love. I mean, it's just conflicting values.
Who?
You know?
Who's come on, well, the Trojan War. I doubt if it happened at all, it wasn't really. Come on.
Well, the idea the idea that Herodotus, in fact, Daniel Robinson, who's an Oxford professor on philosophy, said that, you know, he analyzed Herodotus and why was Herodotus so involved, so obsessed with sort of the details of not just the Persians, but the Hellenic armies, and his conclusion is essentially that people, men who go to war, don't hate each other. Men who go to war are fighting over conflicting values, and they fight under symbols, they fight under slogans, they fight under the idea that their way is better, and they have to essentially protect what they love from that particular group of barbarians who are mistaken and are coming in to change us for the worse. If you look at, there's a book called The Nobility of Failure. The majority of the kamikaze in World War II, the Japanese, were actually not mathematicians. They were students of the humanities. They were students of poetry and things. And they would write these poems home, these haikus to their families before they would die. And I read a number of them. They're quite beautiful. And the idea was I'm sacrificing myself for the love of my country, for the love of my family, and for the love and the sake of purifying or keeping my country and my way of life pure.
Right.
So there seems to be that sort of those are strong undertones. I mean, you know, I think that at West Point, there's a statue, and under the inscription it says, "A nation defines itself upon what it's willing to fight for." I think human beings do the same thing in some ways. You know, you define yourself on what you're willing to fight for, and maybe even die for. I have those principles, and I'd probably
So that's a great example of how. How we are able to commit ourselves to other things. So we commit ourselves to another person, and that's love, and that's generally good for society, good for everyone. We can commit ourselves to an ideology, to a country, to a cause, and you can certainly point to cases where that has been disastrous, particularly when that love is manipulated by a dictator, especially mm-hmm. a fascist dictator, because fascism is all about having the nation be the all-encompassing organism, family, it's all that matters.
Mm-hmm.
But if other than fascism, love of country is actually, I think, a good thing. People on the left are often uncomfortable with it, because people on the left tend to be more universalistic. They don't like divisions between groups. Mm-hmm. That's a very positive thing. I'm not knocking it. But I think that they often are wary of patriotism, mm-hmm. where love of country is overwhelmingly positive. So, yeah. For example, think about intramural sports. If you play sports in college or any other team, you know, you have a team. You have a team of guys on a softball team or soccer, whatever it is. You begin to love them. You work together. You become one. It's thrilling. It's self-transcendent. Now, do you hate the other team? No, you don't. Mm. You really
right.
don't.
Right.
So it's like you get love of the group goes up, but it's not purchased at the cost of hatred for the other side.
Mm.
Now, what can happen is in sports competition, things can get really nasty. There can be a team that's like maybe they fouled you or they did something.
Sure.
Cheats. And then you start – yeah, and so you can develop a rivalry that gets really toxic. Mm. And, you know, British soccer hooliganism is not like intramural. You know, they really want to just beat the hell out of each other. And
they're very good at it, too.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
true. That's
oh, hey, maybe, Brian, maybe you can do your Scottish accent on this.
My Scottish.
You,
that's right. Or a Manchester accent, those guys up there like that, talk like this, very dangerous.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, the other aspect, though, is also, you know, there's a book called Our Inner Ape that I read recently. And, you know, he talks about the different primates and how their chimpanzee is capable of terrible brutality, eating each other's young and stuff like that. But at the same time, they will sometimes, and there are examples in zoos where a chimp adopts a bird with a broken wing that it finds and nurses it back to health. We are a bipolar ape, human beings, aren't we? I mean, we're capable of incredible violence and terrible things, as we all know, and also selfless love to the point of sacrificing our own
that's
lives.
That's right, and that's what makes us such an interesting species to study.
Yeah.
Many, many philosophers or commentators from around the world have noticed that we are part divine, part animal.
Mm.
And that's really one of the themes of both of my books, I'd say.
Well, you are – there need to be more of you. I could talk to you forever. We got to have you back on because there's so much to cover. But we appreciate your time. I know you're busy and stuff. And Hunter, you had one more thing you wanted to ask?
Well, the only thing I was saying, then, it seems like much of what you're saying is that we should strive for transcendence and awe, but make sure that it doesn't go to the place of disgust, right? Mm. That's really the where the problems creep in.
Well, I would put it like this, that most of us do have a need for self-transcendence. I personally am an awe junkie. I love climbing up on rooftops. I love exploring ways to change consciousness. I've had a great time at Burning Man. So, self-transcendence is generally a good thing. Being part of a group is generally a good thing, but at times it can become toxic. And mm-hmm. what's happened in our national life is that the two political parties, while it's good to have parties that make a case for one way of living or one way of running the government and have another opposing it. I mean, that's a good thing to have, you know, as you say, checks and balances and forces pushing against each other. But it can pass a point where it becomes toxic. And we've gone from politics being like baseball to politics being like British soccer hooliganism or rollerball from the 1970s, that science fiction movie.
I like it.
And that's really killing us. So we need to find ways to step back, calm the hell down, and basically just start disagreeing more constructively.
Wow. I like it.
That's awesome.
I'll take that to the bank, my friend. Jonathan, hey, thank you so much. The book, we're going to put it on our website, and you can go, and we have an Amazon banner. Just click through, and it's The Happiness Hypothesis.
And also The Righteous Mind.
And The Righteous Mind, and we'll put both those books on there. And we really appreciate your time, man. I mean, this has been exciting. And by the way, when I come to New York, you're coming to my show. I will make you laugh.
Oh, good. Yes, I would love that.
I'll give
questionnaires to all the other comedians and confirm that you're all curmudgeonly libertarian.
That's what I'm talking about, brother. That's what I'm talking about, man.
All right.
Okay. All right.
Well, Brian and Hunter, it's a pleasure talking with you guys.
Thank you so much, man.
Jonathan.
You're awesome.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Bye. Awesome.
What a rock star, right?
Dude, he's so smart.
Yeah, amazing.
Fuck, I was like, I had so many questions. I'm like sitting there trying to talk. Like, what the fuck else do I say? All right, I'll tell you what I'm going to say. I'll be at the Schaumburg Improv in Illinois. And if you know what's good for you, you people come out and see me because I'm hilarious.
If you want to experience transcendence, if you want to have a religious experience, come to the Schaumburg Improv.
Go to briancallen.com because I'm bringing heat. And I may sound serious here, but I'm hilarious in real life. That's July 25th, 26th, 27th, 28th. I can't wait. And thank you. thanks for tuning in to me and Hunter Motz, who makes this podcast what it is. Later.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.